The following podcast was created to help 100 Women in Finance members learn more about us, our programs and priorities, and especially our people. In this series, we introduce you to our Global Association board members, the people who steer the organization through sound governance and financial management and ensure that we advance our mission. We hope that you enjoy the podcast, and we welcome your feedback at media@100women.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Amanda Pullinger, CEO of 100 Women in Finance. Today I have the privilege of spending a few moments with our board member Diana Cantor, and I hope that you enjoy getting to know her as much as I have over the years. Diana has been on our board since 2013, serving as our treasurer and on the finance committee. Diana has had an extraordinary career by any measure. She's a trained accountant, an MBA, and a lawyer with notable accomplishment in both corporate and public arenas. I'd like to touch on a few of the highlights so that listeners will have a sense of the breadth of Diana's professional life. After a few years as a practicing real estate attorney in her early 20s, she began her finance career at Goldman Sachs, where she co-founded its principal investment group, managing the firm's leveraged buyout and internal investment funds and merchant banking operations. After intervening years in public service, she went back to the private sector as a partner at Alternative Investment Management. A few words about the years of public service. In the mid-90s, Diana founded, developed, and ran the Virginia College Savings 529 Plan, which, for those of you who are outside of the US, is a university tuition savings program that makes college affordable for students in the United States. That role extended for more than a decade. She's currently vice chair and was formerly chair of the Board of the Trustees of the Virginia Retirement System, which is one of the largest pension funds in the United States. Diana also has a number of current and past public and private corporate board appointments to her name, including VC Properties, Domino's Pizza, Revlon, the Edelman Financial Group, Media General, the Universal Corporation, Service King Collision Centers, Vistage International, and Knowledge Universe. Wow. In addition to all this, she is the mother of three adult children with her husband, Eric, who is well known for his public political life, having served in the U.S. House of Representatives as majority leader while representing their home district. Interestingly, Eric joined his wife in the finance world just over 5 years ago as the vice chairman and a managing director of Moelis & Company. So I'm really pleased that our members will have a chance to get to know Diana, the person behind this incredible list of accomplishments, through our conversation today. So with that, welcome, Diana. So let's talk first about your family background and specifically the people and relationships in your formative years that shaped you and the life you have today. I know from our conversations that, for example, your grandmother and your father both had early influences on your career choices. So tell us a bit about your early years.
Hi, Amanda, and thank you so much for the opportunity to have a talk with you today, especially in such an unusual time in this world that we are all living through. This has given me an opportunity to do some reflecting. We would think that sheltering at home gives us lots of time to do that, but somehow, you know, for many that I've spoken to, it seems like a busier time than ever. And you're right. I took some time for a moment to reflect on, you know, the people that were instrumental in me to form who I am today. And my grandmother, really unbeknownst to many in my family, would not really realize this, was a big influencer in my life as far as my eventual interest in business and finance as well. And when I was a little girl, I was born and raised in Miami Beach, Florida. I am a native Floridian. I did the opposite where many people from New York, you know, end up in Florida. I actually left Florida as it was to go to law school, but to go to New York. And that's where I went to law school and started my career, as you've mentioned just now. But when I was a little girl, I remember going to my grandparents' house. They lived a few blocks from us, and I was allowed to walk over there. So I go frequently to, I was the oldest of four children in 5 years, from oldest to youngest. I wanted to get away as much as I could. And my grandmother had a bridge table set up for me in her little sun porch, and she would give me red and green pencils, and she would explain to me that, you know, for all the money she earned as a teacher, and in those days, my grandmother had a degree from what was, you know, Barnard College, Columbia University, which was still very unusual at the time, back, you know, in the early 40s, if you will, and into the 50s. And she was a teacher and saved all her money to invest in the stock market. And she would have me plot, look up in the newspaper. She had the newspapers ready for me. And I was probably 9 or 10 years old at the time, and she would teach me how to look up the closing prices of the shares that she and my grandfather, who was a community doctor, had bought, and to track it. And I knew if there were green dots that I was putting on these charts, it was a really good thing. And if they were red, I had to be really careful and be very and understand that my grandmother would not be so happy about the red dots that I sort of had to put. And that was really how I started to learn about investing early on and how important it was, you know, to a family providing for their children and for others. And then, you know, moving to my father years later, I went through high school and I was very interested in languages. You know, again, I mentioned I grew up in Miami, which was already, you know, starting in the 70s, becoming a very international location. And especially, as we know today, is an extremely internationally oriented place. And I was fluent in Spanish and French at the time. I love languages. I love being able to communicate with people on different fronts. And I was filling out my applications. And my father, who unfortunately died at a very young age, at the time when I was applying to college with paper, you know, my children still can't imagine that I actually had to mail in my college applications and fill them all out by hand. And he walked in and one day and he said, "So I see you're applying for college. What do you think you're going to study?" I said, "Well, I'm going to study languages. I want to be an interpreter at the UN and I want to move to New York City and work at the United Nations." And he said, "Oh, that's great. That's really interesting. But I think you should study accounting." And I looked at him for one of the rare times in my life when I didn't just jump when my dad said something. I said, "Excuse me, with all due respect, why in the world would I ever study accounting?" He said, "Here's the deal. Later in life, since you're so passionate about languages and communicating with people, I think that you will go and learn whatever language you want to know. If you want to go to Germany, you'll go learn German. If you're going to Italy for a job or just for travel, you'll go learn some Italian." I can tell you one thing that is the ultimate truth about our world is that accounting is the language of business. And I don't think you will ever actually go back and want to take accounting if you don't do it now. And that honestly is the way I was influenced to start my accounting career at the University of Florida. And I actually graduated with one of the first degrees in accounting in the country. I actually have a Bachelor of Science in accounting.
Wow. So very, really interesting. And I really appreciate you sharing that and kind of reflecting on how you got started. Because I think a lot of us, you know, often forget where we started from until we're actually in a situation like an interview like this. So we've actually done a couple of these podcasts now, and I recently spoke with your fellow 100 Women board member, Armando Senra, who oversees BlackRock's iShares business in the Americas, about how a career in investing can offer someone an opportunity to effect positive change at great scale. And we specifically talked about the widespread adoption of ESG analysis in company valuation work. Of course, at 100 Women, we additionally encourage our members to think about how their industry experience can be put to use in ways that serve society, typically through volunteering or board service. You seem to have taken that principle to extraordinary length with your work at Virginia College Savings Plan and your board service to the Virginia Retirement System. Can I ask how all of this got started for you and why you've chosen to devote so much of your life towards serving others in this particular way?
You know, thank you again for that question. It's so interesting again, and I appreciate the opportunity to sort of reflect on thematic, parts of my life. And in addition to just speaking about, you know, key influencers on me as a young girl, a young woman, I had a, you know, chance to reflect on the theme of service. And for some reason, service has seemed to just follow me for whatever I've done in my professional and my personal life. And again, going back to my grandmother, it's interesting because I remembered, you know, and it's not something I think about, every day, that at the age of 72, my grandmother raised her hand for public service. She had been head of the Homeowners Association of Miami Beach, and she ran for city council. And not only was that unusual back, you know, then in the late 70s, but for a 72-year-old woman to raise her hand to go onto the Miami Beach City Council at the time of the regentrification of South Beach that everyone, you know, either has been to or has heard about today was a really interesting thing. And I remember, you know, service was a big part of how I grew up in always giving to others. And I think that's what started with me. And, service to, it was really unbeknownst to me. And as you mentioned, my husband and his career, which has been, you know, very parallel to mine. And, I really stayed in the business world. And my husband was elected to his first office at the age of 27 years old. He went into the state house in Virginia called the House of Delegates. And so here I had a partner who was very steeped at a very young age in public service. And I had, you know, moved to Virginia when I got married, and I didn't know anyone. So the first thing I thought of to do to meet people, I didn't know a soul except for my husband and his family. And I joined a lot of boards. And the easiest boards to join, of course, is a volunteer to raise your hand. Or at first I just joined as a volunteer and then, you know, offered whatever ways I could be helpful to sit on the board because, as you mentioned, you know, I did have a business degree and accounting degree. I had finance and legal experience. And I found that I could make a case to sit on the board to be helpful to the organization. So that's really, you know, how I started looking at public service as a way to network with people, to be involved in the community. And it always still today has served me right, you know, to always do for others, and it will always come back to me. The way this got started with me in, you know, public service as a financial career, which is really important. I think some of that today is not immediately top of mind when we think about, especially in our organization of 100 Women in Finance, of women who, you know, don't serve in a traditional corporate world of financial services, but all of the women, and there are so many of them, amazing women who have also chosen to provide a service component to the public through their roles in public service. And actually, you mentioned that my time as the executive director of the Virginia College Savings Plan. At that time, when I became executive director, we had our state treasurer and the chief investment officer of the Virginia Retirement System. At that time, we were all women. And I used to try and highlight that whenever I had an opportunity to speak to the press about how important it was to for everyone to know about how many women were leading the three top public agencies that dealt with personal finance of the state and of families. At that time. So I was appointed to the Treasury Board of the state, and that's where I really learned about state finances and debt and how a state finances itself and budgeting and things like that. And from that, that was how I basically had the connectivity and was asked by the governor when the legislation was passed in Virginia to create a college savings plan, as most states were starting to do at that time in the mid-90s, to come and help get that started.
Fantastic. So interesting. It's so interesting how our lives kind of interweave with, you know, with things that we're passionate about that become our careers at some point. You know, that's obviously part of my own story of, you know, being passionate about 100 women as a volunteer and then as a board member, and then it became my career. And so it's really interesting to hear you talk about that part of your life. You know, another part of your background that our members would certainly find interesting is that you serve, or you have served, on many corporate boards, which I mentioned at the beginning of our talk. You know, a couple that are obviously, one in particular that I see all the time right now, which is Domino's, on the TV channels here in the UK, because I guess they can deliver pizzas during this period of time. But, you know, achieving greater gender balance on corporate boards is something that virtually all corporate leaders want. And at 100 Women, we've, you know, done quite a lot of work over the years in helping our senior practitioner members find their way into these positions. It's not easy, and progress has been relatively slow. So given that you've been so successful in this arena, I wonder if you'd share how you obtained your first appointment to a corporate board, and perhaps offer some advice to 100 women members who have similar ambitions in this area.
You know, thank you for that question. It's a really important one, and I want to bring it, you know, to another theme, I think, that we can, you know, talk about today, which is connectivity, relationships, and networking, which is why 100 Women in Finance is so important to me. As you've sort of outlined, you know, I do a lot of things with my time these days, and one of the most important allocations of my, you know, of my capital, my personal capital, which is my time, is to 100 Women in Finance, because the connection that and the networking that is available to, you know, not only certainly as a board member, but as the member that I was and continue to be, and for all of the women around the world who we hope to provide a place of resource, connectivity, and networking, so important to how to accomplish some of the missions that we have, and that especially in the corporate and board world and the not-for-profit board world as well. And so thinking back to networking and connectivity, the basic formula, honestly, is connecting with people and raising your hand and putting yourself out there. And it's interesting, before I go to the boards, I'll tell you a very quick anecdote about how I came to work at Goldman Sachs. It's not a position that I saw that I applied for. It was a really, again, one of those unique situations in my life where a door was opened for me. I knew nothing about it and just decided to take the risk and walk through it, which is also the case with looking at serving on many boards. And I was sitting in my office as a young real estate lawyer, as you mentioned, on Park Avenue in New York City. And a young associate who was working with me came in and she said, "Oh, Diana, I just had this interview downtown, but I told them they want you and not me." And because you love that calculator on your desk. Remember, we also had no computers when I started practicing law. I think maybe I didn't even have a typewriter. Some of the, you know, higher level assistants, we called them secretaries at the time, had typewriters. And it was very interesting. And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, I just had this interview with this firm called Goldman Sachs, and they're looking for someone who has, you know, I told them they want you because you had all the skill sets they were looking for. And if it weren't for this young lady, who today actually is a federal judge, so I won't use her name, but she recognized even then the power of helping your friends and providing information about them that they might not have access to or providing on their own." So that's why it's so important, especially on our website for 100 Women, we have some of these tools that will help women network and get access to these potential positions and services and boards that, you know, they may be interested in. So really what I did is, first of all, do your homework and have a clear idea of what makes you a good board member. I mean, I had, you know, the advantage or the opportunity set of having, you know, served in a number of jobs at that point. I had already served on the public board. I had been on several nonprofit boards, and that is what I recommend to a lot of young women who call me about, you know, how should I get on board? How can I be board ready? I said, first of all, have you ever served on a board? And what I meant to say also before is I had the advantage of serving as a staff member to a board. And I think that's really important, reporting to a board. Even when I worked at Goldman Sachs and was leading the principal investments group for a time, I reported to the Goldman Sachs, you know, executive committee and the management committees, but I also had huge boards to help, you know, who are overseeing, you know, the administration and the investment of the funds that we were raising internally. And so I learned what it was like to be on the other side of a board seat. And I think that's very important in always putting yourself on the other side of what you're doing in a job, in a role, and whatever it is, to think about how they think. And so I tell the mostly younger people that come to me for some counsel, that I would certainly volunteer for a nonprofit board in your community. Raise your hand and do that. And that will start, as I mentioned, networking and getting somebody out there. And also, don't be afraid to put yourself out. You know, have a board-ready resume. And the way I got on my first board, which was in 2005, I think I was probably in my mid-40s then, was I knew the CEO because I had served on a board with him, and he was able to see how, you know, I collaborated, how I was as a board member working as a team. And when it was time for him to look for another board member, and, you know, even then there were several companies starting to look to add more women on their boards, he called me and said, I'd like to speak to you about joining our board. And today, I'm not saying it's easier, because I know our progress has been slow, but it is moving forward and a much more, you know, fast pace than we had seen before. And hopefully it will just continue. But I can tell you today, there are so many resources out there that young women can find and to become board ready. A lot of the women that I speak to now have already participated in board ready courses. They have board ready resumes, which is very different than if you're applying for a job. It really is a different take on how you would add to a board. I'd also, as the last thing, encourage all of our members who are listening to this to look at the proxy statements. Many of the companies now have matrices that they are reporting on and disclosing that show you the types of skill sets and capabilities that they are looking for in their board members. I was lucky in the sense that I could come on and chair public company audit committees. You don't have to be a CPA to do that. You just do have to be financially literate, which is actually a term that is used, and a financial expert. And that is more broadly defined than someone might think. So take a look at that. That would be my advice right now, is to raise your hand, go volunteer, sign up, serve on some boards so you really understand what that's like. And then do your board readiness. And the last thing I will say, there are many, many private companies that have boards set up or advisory boards. And many times that is a great stepping stone to serving on a public company board, is to get your start with a private company, to start to learn, you know, how to be a really good corporate board member.
Those are all really fantastic practical views on how to do this, and I really appreciate you thinking through that. I'm just going to add one thing that I know you said during the conversation that we had the other day, and that is that you learned at an early age that you should treat people well in every encounter, because they may come back around again. So I just wanted to add that bit in as well. And it goes to your networking, not for the sake of networking, but really about building relationships, because you never know. I know in my own life, you never know when somebody that you worked with, served on a board with 20 years ago, comes back around. So make sure that you treat people well. I thought it was a really good piece of advice that you gave the other day.
Yes, absolutely right. And thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. And it is so true, you know, no matter who you run into, you should always anticipate that at some point in your life, at some time, they may cross your path again. And other stories for other times, but thank you.
Exactly. You have some wonderful stories, which we'll leave to another time, right?
Yes.
But I think very good advice again. So finally, if you're willing, I'd love to talk to you about your partnerships in life. While your husband was away in Washington, D.C., and your three children were young and at home, you built a large public institution, Virginia's 529 plan, as you mentioned. I'm assuming that balance is not a word you'd necessarily have chosen to describe your life at that time, but somehow you and your husband were able to simultaneously pursue hard-charging professional lives and achieve great success while raising a young family. I wonder if you have some thoughts to offer about how a spouse, a partner, or even a close network of friends can help to sustain a long and successful career.
Wow. Well, you know, thank you for that question, especially as we close up our time here together today. You know, it's interesting. The one person I have not really focused on who really deserves, you know, and my husband would say the same thing, most of the credit for my being able to do and accomplish, I believe, as much as I have, is my mother. And still today, my mother and I are isolating, sheltering at in Richmond, Virginia, where my home is, while my mother has lived with us now for 20 years. And that was her raising her hand to be of help. When my husband knew that the opportunity was open for him to run for a congressional seat, which meant that he would be not living in Richmond, Virginia during the week, he called my mother. And I know this is very unusual. And he said he was not going to run if she couldn't come live with us, because I was working full time as a state employee. You know, my husband was in his family business and also serving as a part time legislator at the Virginia House of Delegates. But now this would be a full time position. And my mother, you know, left her life in Miami and moved to Richmond, Virginia, which was a hard thing to do, I think, also. But my mother worked when I grew up, you know, her whole life. So I always knew my mother as a working mom. And because my dad also, when he was alive, traveled during the week elsewhere. It was very ironic how my life tended to have some repetition in it, in my world. And she came and was a co-parent. And that's the way we were able, really, I was able to devote a big part of my life. But nonetheless, that was really, I think, my secret weapon. But achieving balance is very important. And although my husband was in Washington serving, you know, as a congressman for 14 years, and certainly in leadership for most of those years, he always made it a point, as did I, to make sure that we created some balance in our life for our children and for ourselves. And balance is so important. And it's interesting today, in this time that we are having this wonderful chat, that we are all in at least a moment in time or a pause in our world at some level, where the most ironic thing I've heard from many of my colleagues, many of the men and women that I work with at Alternative Investment Management, AIM 13, as we call it, my office in New York City, is how much busier they feel being at home, which is sort of a fascinating construct. I know you and I, you know, are used to working at home various parts of our days and things like that. So this is not so unusual for me. But it's interesting how now families are reassessing the balance in their life and looking to their network of friends and family in different ways. And just while the workforces of the future, starting today, are reexamining now what their workforce transition is going to be, what workplace processes and procedures they're going to be in order to ensure the safety of the most important asset that every firm has, which is their human capital. We also have been given an opportunity, if you will, to take stock of our lives and to reassess how we move forward in a time where safety and security is certainly foremost in everyone's mind, and the networking that is available today virtually, electronically, you know, things like that is so wonderful in order to bring more connection to us around the world. So I think, you know, in balance, what we have, it was always for me reaching out to my friends. And the one thing that I would add, and it sort of tacked onto that little story about always doing for someone else and recognizing someone else, no matter who they are, if it's someone opening a door for you in a restaurant, hopefully soon, in an office building, whatever it is, being kind and respectful, always understanding they may have a different life perspective than you. It's something that also achieved a good balance with me. My husband and I, you know, over the years, people would ask us that, you know, both of us come from a different political persuasion, certainly growing up, and have different opinions and beliefs about, you know, various aspects of life and the world and policy. But yet we always respected each other's position. And that was very important, I think, in anything that we do, either at home or in the professional world, is to always realize that that doesn't mean someone's wrong just because they don't have the same exact feeling as you do. And I think it's been very important, even back to our 100 Women in Finance board work. We have a large board. We're very collaborative. We have great committees that work together, and we also leverage ourselves with all of our members around the world. And understanding they come from different life experiences, have different views on many different topics, it's important to sit and listen before we just go out with our position. So I hope that gives you some sense about balance in many different arenas of how we live and work. And that's how I intend to further commit myself to being a really good listener and stopping to think about things from other perspectives before I speak or act.
Diana, would you just finally, would you mind sharing the lovely story you told about Eric and C-SPAN and the kids?
Oh my goodness, thank you. So it, when my husband first left to go to Washington, as you mentioned, my children were not babies, but they were at certainly an impressionable age where they missed their daddy, especially when their mommy came home, and they used to call me the homework monster, because they had grandma with them all day and who, you know, certainly was not overly permissive, I hope. I don't know. They turned out okay. They, you know, but, you know, they would want, where's our daddy? You're so mean to us, you know, because I was making them finish their homework. But at the time, we didn't have FaceTime or Skype or Zoom or anything that is available today to keep connectivity. And we did have television. And this was, you know, starting, my husband was elected to Congress in 2000. And my children were 6, 8, and 10 at the time. And C-SPAN was around every night and was on. And so every night when it was, you know, dinner was finished, homework was done, and we were getting ready for bedtime routines, I would turn on the television, which normally wasn't allowed at night, and I would call my husband, Eric, and I would tell him, okay, the kids are going to get ready for bed now. We're going to do bath time, whatever we were doing. And he said, okay, I'm going to go down in the well of the house floor, and you can turn on the TV, and I'll wave to the kids goodnight. And that's how they knew where their dad was. And getting back just one more time to the theme about public service, and I know you had a wonderful podcast with our chair, Lauren Malafronte, and she talked about her daughter, who is really doing, you know, for this country, the ultimate in public service, you know, through the Naval Academy at this point in her life. And, you know, I would tell my kids when they would start to, you know, they always miss their father, certainly during the weeks when he was in D.C., because we did not move there, that, you know, it was like, you know, many people who had dedicated themselves, and they did have friends who had parents who had, who were in the, one of our military service branches. And I said, you know, this is your dad doing his public service, you know, helping, you know, to do things to help families, you know, in our area and around the country. And they sort of got that from a very early age. And so they would see him there at a place and knowing that he was thinking of them at the end of every night. So thank you for asking me to share that, you know, personal part of our really, family.
Yeah, it really touched me. And so I thought others would like to hear that story about how you kind of reimagined that in-person goodnight kiss, you know, every
yeah.
day. So that's wonderful. So, Diana, why don't we stop there for now? Thanks so much for sharing, and I look forward to seeing you at our next board meeting.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, and stay safe and healthy, and I wish that for all of our members of 100 Women in Finance.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Remember to follow 100 Women in Finance on our LinkedIn page. You can also enjoy our past programs and connect with other members in the private section of our website, Community.